Hello and welcome to Talking Capital. I'm Ian Barnard, CEO of CapGen. Each month, I'm joined by a member of our investment team or a guest from one of the investors in our universe to talk about the investment themes and opportunities that are available today to family investors. What is CapGen? We're a private investment office for families with capital. Our clients are sophisticated, internationally minded investors, and what we do is to help them make the most of their capital and to seek out investment opportunities across any asset class in any region of the world. So in the course of these episodes, you can expect us to cover a globally diversified portfolio of assets and sectors, be that bricks and mortar or derivatives. In summary then, this is a podcast where we discuss the questions that we think are playing on the minds of sophisticated long-term investors. If that sounds up your street, do please subscribe and you'll enjoy a new episode published on the first Thursday of each month. Welcome to Talking Capital. Today's interview is the first in a three-part series covering responsible capital, and I'm thrilled to have with me today the chair of our Responsible Capital Committee and senior associate at the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership, and many other roles he holds, Dimitri Zengelis. So Dimitri, welcome. Thank you for joining us. We've got our usual three topics to cover, from the US president through the global shift towards renewables and natural capital as a barrier to growth. And we're going to look particularly in that latter one at the UK. Well, let's kick off with, I think, you know, a topic that question we're asked quite a lot is, you know, has Donald Trump changed everything? So has his very vocal dislike of sort of ESG, the green agenda, what he would perhaps call as out of control woke, has his return to the presidency turned everything on its head and slowed down the pace of change towards a more sustainable future?
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me here to talk. I think the answer to that question is yes and no. Now, clearly, a major economy like the US backpedaling on its support for transitioning to renewable energy and corresponding with that a massive increase in electrification will, all else equal, slow the pace of the transition down. It provides additional uncertainty to investors in terms of the US market and in terms of the size of the global market and the export opportunities for those new technologies. So in that sense, it's unhelpful. However, does it make any difference to the secular trend towards electrification and renewables? And the answer is a very clear no. The world is transitioning to renewable electricity combined with storage and electrification so that you increase end use technologies such as electric vehicles, heat pumps and so on, which can then feed back into the grid to the extent that they themselves might have storage in the form of batteries. That's a much more efficient way of generating energy, much more efficient than burning molecules, with a few exceptions like aviation, where high density weight to energy ratios that fossil fuels provide are very difficult to replace. As a result of this, the world has, you know, really for the last few decades, been investing predominantly in renewable energy as a source of electricity generation. That's the world, right? I'm not talking about Europe or Scandinavia, it's the world. Indeed, even in the US right now, with all the Trump talk and the withdrawal of subsidies, most electricity investment in the US is in renewables, mostly solar power. So this is an unstoppable momentum as the old capital is retired, gas plants, coal plants taken off the grid and replaced by renewable plants. The world is going to decarbonize its electricity markets.
So I think what you're effectively saying, Dimitri, is the trend is in a direction. You're saying that globally, including the US, the trend towards both electrification and renewables as a source of electricity continues to go upwards. But in that broad trend, you obviously get sort of sine wave ups and downs, and there's a bit of a down at the moment because the US, both in terms of sort of tone and debate, but also in terms of financial support is pulling back slightly. So big picture, the trend continues. And I think you said something there, Dimitri, that I'm going to ask you to expand a little bit upon, because I know you've talked to us about it, which is the fact that what we're talking about is not just a transition to a low carbon future. It's also separately and independently a transition to an electric future, that actually an important part of what we're seeing, regardless of where it comes from, is just electrification. Can you talk a bit about that?
So you're absolutely right, Ian. And this is actually a key to understanding why the world is investing so heavily in renewables and why it provides such an economic opportunity in terms of cutting the cost of energy. In essence, what you have here is an application of something called Wright's Law in a market that's based on a modular, scalable, replicable kit that you plug into an electricity network to generate energy for electricity-compatible products, goods and services, which is actually most things. If I walk in here with a canister of gas or a lump of coal, I wouldn't be able to power your internet or get your lifts, elevators to go up and down. If you feed into an electricity grid, that's a very versatile source of energy, which transports much more easily across grids, electricity grids, than molecules do in tankers, pipes, and so on. The other advantage, and perhaps the most important advantage of a system based on renewables and electricity, is that it's subject to increasing returns to scale. What we're seeing, and this is where Wright's Law comes into this, what we're seeing is that every time you expand deployment of electricity, you get a reduction, corresponding reduction in cost. This was first identified, or at least first publicized, by one of the Wrights brothers, who identified that every time they double aeroplane production, their costs fall by some amount. In the electricity market, we're seeing the cost of solar PV and batteries fall by about 30% every time global output doubles. Wind, more mature capital-intensive technologies, a bit lower than that, maybe around 20% or so. But this generates a reinforcing feedback, you see. So every time the world deploys and installs renewable technologies, their costs fall. Of course, when their costs fall, the incentive to deploy more renewable technologies goes up. And what we know about reinforcing feedback, think about putting a microphone next to a speaker, is that they generate very rapid and unexpected change. And that is what we're seeing here. We're seeing rapid, unexpected change. China took a strategic lead on this, so it now is responsible for about 3/4 of the world's market in electric vehicles, in battery storage, in solar PV, about 2/3 of the world's market in wind. If you have economies of scale, that's what happens. You tend to get clustering in certain production centers. Now, contrast that with fossil fuels and the extractive economy in general. What you have there is diminishing returns to scale. If you want to extract more oil and gas or coal, you will have to go to an ever more remote location and use exotic techniques to get it out of the ground. You then have to put it in pipes, in trains, on ships, transport it across the world, and then burn it. And once you've done that, you've got to go back and do the whole thing again. That is much more expensive for one simple reason. It ties up an awful lot of labor in the process. And one commodity whose price goes up and up and up is labor. And it's the reason why, even though solar PV costs since the 1950s, when they were first deployed in satellite technology, have come down by about 99.9%, the cost per joule of final energy from coal, oil, and gas since the 1950s has not come down one iota. That's not because we don't burn the stuff more efficiently. It's because of all the labor that's tied into that. Now, you mentioned electricity. Part of making that network cost effective involves investing in the electricity grid. And we may talk about how that the costs of doing that are taken on in the near term. But once you have an electricity grid, then you're able to use end-use products like batteries and EVs and heat pumps and all the rest of it. And actually, in terms of production, these offer higher margins than wind and solar in many parts of the world. So the opportunity is massive, and the Chinese recognize this, which is why China has managed now to account for almost 1/3 of the world's electricity capacity. You compare that with the US and the EU, which are lagging behind at sort of 15 and 20% of the electricity capacity globally. they're still relying on old fossil fuels, which are expensive.
I want to pardon the pun, but I want to transition to China in a moment. But I just want to quickly sort of wrap up, I think, what you're saying on electrification. I think you're saying two things. You're saying it's superior, one, because as a way of getting energy from its source to its use, it's just clearly more straightforward, more efficient, more versatile, and more needed for the things that we use more and more every day. So from a consumer point of view, it's superior. But on top of that, from a producer point of view, it's superior because you've got this Wright's law, production scale, scaling saving. So it's cheaper to produce, easier to produce. Oh, and the product at the end of it from a consumer point of view is a superior product.
Which is why the world is investing so rapidly in these technologies. It's also, and it's worth a moment of reflection, tells you why AI, China is very confident about prospects for developing leadership in AI. AI is very energy intensive, as you know, a lot of compute, a lot of data centers. If AI's costs converge on the cost of energy, it's very likely that they will want to locate in China, where the prospects for low energy prices are much, much higher than in the US, certainly, and also to some extent than Europe.
Let's come on and talk about China, because you've already shown us just how big a player it is in this whole area. And I, you know, the best policies, I always think, are ones from a government point of view, are when you are able to tick lots and lots of boxes. And clearly one of the boxes the China ticks when it makes this transition to electricity and renewables is it ticks reducing geostrategic dependence on fossil fuels being delivered along maritime shipping lanes that are controlled by its rival power, the US. So even if you didn't have the benefits of electrification, I think as a Chinese policymaker, geostrategically, you'd want to do it, because that way you create, reminding ourselves of the vulnerability the Japanese had in the run-up to World War II around energy dependence and the fact that that was controlled by the US because they controlled the maritime shipping lane. So China sees the same strategic vulnerability. So it's going to go down this path almost from a geostrategic point of view alone. But on top of that, I think you're saying, Dimitri, that because good policies always tick lots of boxes, there's this other box, which is this is a bit the future and they're getting ahead of it. And they're seeing not just the, the direct benefits of strategic independence and of diminishing costs of production and therefore efficiency, and the fact that from a consumer point of view, a lot of the things that we consume now need electricity. On top of that, if AI in a way becomes a bit of a utility, in a sense, where it's all about the marginal cost of electricity, which is the cost of delivering a reply to your ChatGPT question. If you create an electricity infrastructure that is scaling, you're just going to have an unassailable competitive advantage. That's a bit what you're saying, isn't it?
It is. So why China? I think that's a very good question. China's taken a strategic lead. It's cornered the market in these key sectors that are going to determine our energy future. And it's also taken a lead in some of the end products, most notably electric vehicles. Now, the European car makers and American car makers have for a long time been saying that, deploying electric vehicles, it's too early, the technology is too expensive, it's untested, it's too soon. And then we wake up one morning and it's too late. China's cornered the market, and now we're worried about the dumping of cheap electric vehicles on our shores. Well, what happened there, and why did we not react with the same proactive strategic view as the Chinese? Well, there are many reasons for that, some good, some bad. China obviously can afford to take a strategic view in a way that, it doesn't have to worry to the same extent about the, piffling niceties of democracy. It can plan ahead despite opposition. However, I don't think it's that simple. China took a strategic view because it had engineers in government, people like Wang Gang, who were accomplished engineers in the automotive sector, who understood that the future lay in electric vehicles and that China did not have a comparative advantage in the combustion engine. It would have to catch up with German engineering, and that will take time. So it understood that putting a little bit of subsidized public money into a sector that could scale like it has, could allow it the opportunities that we are now seeing. It also was responding to politics. I mean, part of it was, as you say, energy security. Another non-trivial part of it was the pollution that was occurring in Chinese cities, particulate pollution, but nonetheless related to fossil fuel use, both burning coal in power stations and combustion engine vehicles in their ever-expanding cities. So part of this was a political decision to placate the Chinese middle classes in what was increasingly seen as a domestic problem. So good and bad reasons led to China taking a lead. But I think a very important reason is that China was less prone to see progress in this sector stymied by incumbent vested interests.
Very interesting, Dimitri. So you're saying you had policymakers who had an engineering background and were thinking strategically about, if you like, gaps in the market. What was the space that China could occupy that wasn't occupied by others? Oh, and on top of that, you have the pollution issues, which as they become wealthier as citizens and consumers was moving up their agenda, sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs and all that sort of thing. You care about pollution when your basic needs are met. But I think you're also saying there was sort of freedom of maneuver and less opposition. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Right. So that's a really good question, Ian. I mean, a lot of people listening might be saying, look, who's this kind of new economy evangelist here telling us that the transition is happening so rapidly and much faster than expected? That's not what I read in the papers. You read the papers, you'll hear a story that's fashionably gloomy. You know, you'll hear a story about backpedaling in America, net zero targets being loosened in Europe, EV growth having stalled, banks having withdrawn from the Net Zero Alliance and all the rest of it. You think, well, you know, actually, this is really, this is not happening at the pace that was expected. Now, that is bunkum, but it's deliberate bunkum. Let's take electric vehicles. I mean, even some of the serious papers have come up with headlines like electric vehicle growth has stalled. You look at the numbers in order to figure out what stalled means, and you find that actually last year, electric vehicle sales grew by 25%, that for the first time in a long time, electric vehicle sales overtook combustion engine sales in the EU. Now, that's not what I would think of as stalling, and it's certainly nothing close to what was expected and all the major analysts 10 years ago. Nobody expected penetration of electric vehicles to be as high as it is, nor penetration of renewables and batteries as well. In fact, it didn't even mark an outlier scenario in some of the most challenging stress tests that were applied at the time. Why is that? Well, I've already given the answer. It's because when you have these reinforcing feedbacks, where deployment breeds cost reductions and cost reductions breed deployment, with very kind of technology driven sectors of induced innovation, you get rapid and unexpected change. And that is exactly what we've got. But there's a fashionable tendency to talk doom and gloom, and that is not an accident. If you're a half respectable oil executive, and the oil industry, we need to understand, has spent the last few decades trying to slow down the transition to electrification and renewables. Obviously, that makes sense from a commercial perspective. It began by talking up climate skepticism. This is all about sunspots and tilts in the Earth's axis. Climate change isn't happening. Then they accepted it's happening, but it's not man-made. And then they accepted it was man-made. And by the way, by the time these arguments have been resolved, we've lost decades of progress because there's so much sort of gumph and misinformation out there. Then they accepted climate change is happening, but it's far too expensive to do anything about it. And anyway, there's no point us doing something about it if your competitors aren't going to do anything because the atmosphere is a global public good. And then finally, it became very obvious that a lot of countries were doing things, and they were doing things because actually it was cost effective and commercially in their self-interest, China being foremost amongst those examples. So what do they do now? Well, what the fossil fuel industry is doing now is precisely fueling this notion that, yes, it's a problem. Yes, we need to transition. But these policymakers are just not moving fast enough. And it's just not happening at the pace we expected. Therefore, we're going to need fossil fuels as a transition fuel for the immediate future, indeed for the next few decades. Now, of course, we are going to need fossil fuels as a transition fuel, as a bridging fuel over the next few decades. But that is not the same thing as saying that the transition is failing to proceed apace. It's happening, and it's actually happening much, much faster than we expected. We're going to reach peak fossil fuel use probably this year, if not in the next couple of years. That's because China's reaching peak fossil fuel use. India is electrifying and using renewables at a much faster pace than we expected, and much faster than China did at this stage of its development. The parts of the world that matter, that are fastest growing, that are expanding, are leapfrogging the West and moving straight to electrification and renewables. That means there's not much future in fossil fuels, but the fossil fuel industry doesn't want you to know that, because oil is a verifungible commodity. It's storable. And if there's not much future in oil and gas, then the price is affected today. And we're seeing a little clue on that in what's going on in Venezuela. The oil companies were not sort of, you know, tripping over each other in order to tap Venezuelan oil. They understand that, you know, high marginal extraction cost oil is not going to be commercially viable in the economy of the 21st century.
Dimitri, very, very persuasive, very compelling. I think I wanted just to make a little observation, because I was thinking about driverless cars. So if driverless cars are the intersection of electric vehicles plus AI, and we're saying that AI is really AI efficiency, cost of delivery are really a function of electricity, then when you're talking about driverless cars, for both those reasons, both from the EV point of view, but also from the AI point of view, advantage is going to come to those that have the lowest marginal cost of electricity production.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the problem with driverless cars is more of a, you know, legal liability insurance problem than anything else. It's driverless cars are a classic combinatorial technology. That is to say, you know, we're familiar with the O-ring theory. They are a function of all the bits of the technology coming together effectively. So you need sensor technology, you need GPS, you need high processing power, you need optical technologies, and so on, in order to make them work. And if any one of those elements fails, the driverless car fails. And a driverless car failing is toxic, because, you know, if you unfortunately drive over a child on a street because one part of that integrated system didn't quite deliver as it was expected to, that is potentially the end of a commercial future for that car maker. And I think it's stuck on that particular issue. But your broader point is right. A lot of these end-use technologies, which are very tech-driven, data-driven, processing-driven, will rely on electricity. And so electrification, renewables, digitization, and AI are bedfellows. They are the set, you know, there are two sides, if you like, of the very same coin. They go together very well. Your solar PV panel has much more in common with your laptop than it does with your boiler. That's true in terms of end use applications, as we've already said. It's also it's also true of production. The same kinds of factories that produce wafer fabrication for your silicon chips are the same kinds of factories that produce solar PVs. Very similar kinds of scale economies, very integrated forms of production. So, you know, it's absolutely the case that the US, in backpedaling on electrification and renewables, is really starting to stymie its technology sector in a way that the Chinese are fully aware of, and actually, I think, rubbing their hands rather gleefully.
Dimitri, thank you. I want to move on to talk a bit about natural capital. So to talk about those assets in the natural environment that provide economic services. I mean, for example, we all remember this from school, the water cycle. Water evaporates off the sea into cloud, it's blown inland, it then rains and it goes into the water system, and it allows us to drink water and to wash our clothes. And there you have a natural capital system that delivers hugely valuable and basic and very much taken for granted economic services or social services, depending on how they're charged. Can you talk a little bit about where we are on that, and perhaps zooming a little bit onto the UK, where my sense is, you know, whilst we might not be doing an amazing job on electrification, perhaps, you know, we're looking a little bit better at natural capital, at least thinking about these natural capital systems?
Yeah, so this is a really good question. I mean, natural capital is critically important. There's a lot of focus on climate. Climate matters, obviously, but you can't really disentangle natural capital from climate. You're not going to get emissions reductions of the kind we need unless you restore natural capital, in particular forests and other carbon sinks. But you're not going to get, at the same time, you're not going to get natural capital recovering if you've got runaway climate change. So the two go together. And the broad way of thinking of natural capital, and this is a term I'm not sure all your listeners are familiar with, but it's something that I focused on when I set up a small team at the University of Cambridge looking at what we called the wealth economy, which looked at more comprehensive and inclusive wealth so that you factor in things like natural and social capital, which are critical to an economy's production, to productive performance. Many of your listeners, if they've done a sort of undergraduate economic course or even a course at school, will be familiar with the notion of a production function. In order to produce, to generate output, you need labor and you need capital. And the two are multiplicative, which is to say, if you've got no labor, then your capital is going to be completely unproductive. And if people have actually got no tools, then labor is going to be more or less unproductive. Well, you can break capital down into many different sort of slices and sub-slices, but it turns out that the only one that's going down, and remember, this is a multiplicative function, the only form of capital that's going down in our production function is natural capital. The others are all going up, whether it's human capital, intangible capital, physical produced capitals, where generally we've got more and more of that stuff. So the risk is that natural capital, because again, it is a multiplicative function, holds back the productivity of all the other forms of capital. And we are seeing that. Natural capital is increasingly, its depletion and the degradation of the environment is increasingly becoming a source of a barrier to growth. Natural capital provides provisioning services. You mentioned the water table, fisheries, forests, peatlands, and so on, which if you deplete and degrade them, then generate a lot of commercial and indeed fiscal risks that have to be covered and ultimately paid for. And so increasingly, we want to measure natural capital as best we can, and we want to generate an asset class through monetization, property rights, and contracts that allows us to, as with, infrastructure investment, to generate markets in doing the things that restore natural capital, restoring forests, restoring mangroves in parts of the world prone to floods from hurricanes. In the UK, restoring kelp forests and re-wiggling rivers and replenishing our watersheds, as you've already said. But treating that as an infrastructure asset class, which allows us to continue to invest in natural capital. Otherwise, we continue to have a misallocation of investment, which undermines our productivity growth.
Because I guess, economics is the study of how we allocate scarce resources to limitless needs. And I guess, we've felt that the natural environment was limitless and we're discovering it's not. And the more of us and the more things that we do, the more limited it is. And therefore, we've got to incorporate it into our economic system and have a price mechanism and all those sorts of things. But I guess that has to be done at a governmental regulatory level. My sense is it doesn't. Maybe it does. You tell me. It doesn't have, people start by bartering very low level within communities, and then, we move on to stores of value to ease trade, and then finally you get to central banks and fiat money. Do you see a pricing mechanism for natural capital evolving organically, or is it going to need top-down regulation to create those markets?
So a bit of both. I mean, you're absolutely right. We are depleting that asset class, and it's not very substitutable with other forms of assets. There's a limit to how much you can replace, forests with, concrete flyovers. Or a lot of nature is not innately substitutable as a core provisioning service. It's the bees that pollinate. If you try and replicate that through other forms of capital, it's incredibly complicated and expensive, and there are lots of spillovers and ecosystem integrations that you will overlook. So natural capital, the cheapest way to sustain our productive capacity is in many cases to restore and replenish natural capital right now in a world where it's deeply degraded. It will be the market that does this, but it will require some lead from policymakers to create the property rights, to create the incentives. A lot of the returns to natural capital are socialized. But that's not unusual. A lot of the returns to many infrastructure investments are socialized. We build high-speed railways, not that successfully in some parts of the world, but we build them because we recognize that the social spillovers of an integrated, connected economy are greater than the cost of the infrastructure itself. And we recognize that the private sector, without a public lead, will underinvest in things like infrastructure, utilities, grids, and so on, which is why the public sector takes a role. I don't think natural capital is really any different. But it just requires a recognition of the social returns to restoring natural capital and an identification of who the beneficiaries are, whether it's businesses or government, in terms of those who ultimately carry the financial and fiscal risks. Property holders whose properties become valueless if they can't insure them because they're in a floodplain, they will be beneficiaries. And creating the contracts, creating the markets, that allow you to monetize that and generate an asset class will then allow you worldwide to generate a multi-trillion dollar asset class, because this is important infrastructure that we're talking about.
And how, being a little bit local, how are we doing in the UK?
Actually, the UK is not doing too badly. I mean, it's seen in some regards, and I'm not a UK expert, but on this sector. But my understanding is it's seen as something of a pioneer, something of a leader in some of the areas that matter. In particular, the UK's mandatory biodiversity net gain program, which I think imposes a requirement amongst developers that they ensure a 10% increase in biodiversity, helps provide some protection and indeed creation of biodiverse habitats. And I think when you scale that up across the country, that's something that's beginning to have an impact. We've also got new markets in biodiversity credits for woodlands and for peatlands in the UK. That's helpful. The UK was early to subscribe to something called the Task Force for Nature-Related Disclosures, mirroring our application of the Task Force for Climate-Related Disclosures. And we are investing, I think, quite significant sums in monitoring and managing this through things like kind of sensors and earth observation technologies, terrestrial airborne and satellite technologies, in order to monitor and then value the UK's, and particularly England's, I think, natural assets. I think England has taken a bit of a lead on some of these issues, and the signs are that this has led to some behavioural change. Now, I'm not an expert. I'm not kept up to date with this, and doubtless it's not enough. But I think in a world where good shouldn't be the enemy of the best, I think we're making good progress here.
Dimitri, thank you, and that's a very helpful segue for me to say that we're very excited in a future episode to have Kate Russell of Tellus Natural Capital come to talk to us about this very question of natural capital, how you measure it, how you create a structure around it, and use incentives to preserve and rebuild our natural capital. Just as we wrap up, I want to come back to something that you said, Dimitri, which is we shouldn't see you as some sort of woke new green economy evangelist sort of trying to describe or to persuade us to move towards this utopian world. What you're really saying is actually it's happening already, and it's happening for sort of hard, compelling, technological, economic reasons. And it's a question not so much of whether we should. There is a moral dimension to it, clearly. And you're quite clear on where you are on that. But even if you move that to one side and just look at the hard reality, it is happening, and it is something that we individually, nationally, and I suppose as investors need to be cognizant of and to make sure we're the right side of.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, look, don't take my word for any of this. Why not just go straight to any International Energy Agency publication or their database and see for yourself? I think you will be left aghast at the pace at which this change is happening. And, you know, you can dismiss the International Energy Agency as a bunch of Marxists with their own agenda, if you like, and then feel free to come up with your own numbers. But I think most sensible and objective players will look at the data and, you know, to the extent that they either rely on it or analyze it, will see that this is something that's irreversible now. And you can, you know, take a quick glance at the commercial opportunities that some of the early movers are now availing themselves of, in particular in China. I mean, 10 years ago, when a bunch of us were talking about how rapid this change could be because we understood the dynamics of induced innovation in an economy, people kind of, you know, people tended to sort of smirk and ask for evidence that this is happening. And they would say that the evidence is that this isn't happening and that the new technologies continue to be eye-wateringly expensive. Well, thankfully, 10 years on, we can now point to examples where this is happening. And I think, you know, those that continue to drag their feet on this are just either in denial or have you know, drunk the Kool-Aid that the incumbents have imposed on them. And of course, look, this is a massive transition. There will be a lot of feathers that are ruffled. There will be a lot of losers in this sector. And these losers, because they've been successful, have access to a lot of capital, which they can deploy to slowing the process down. This isn't ideological. It's a statement of fact. That's how the world is. If I was, you know, a senior executive in the oil industry, it would be, you know, an abrogation of my responsibilities if I were to start talking up electrification and renewables, because that would have an impact on the oil price today. So it doesn't happen. But people, I think, need to take a sort of clear-headed and objective view on what is going on if they're to be the right side of this change and if they're to make the most of the opportunities. I will say this, to the extent that the fossil fuel lobby and others are managing to slow this process down, it does mean that obviously fossil fuel assets are overpriced. But the flip side of that is that a lot of these new renewable technologies continue to be underpriced because the mean expectation has yet to catch up with the reality of what is going on. In that sense, you know, these people are helping provide a greater opportunity from investing in some of these new sectors than would otherwise be the case if rationality prevailed.
Dimitri, that's awesome. Thank you very much indeed. Love this conversation. Thank you very much for joining us. And thank you for listening. Thanks. Bye-bye. A link to CapGen's privacy notice and full terms can be found in this podcast summary description and on our website.